Hi, I'm Ken Yale, a producer for Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy program. This is my full interview with Dekwi Kioni Sadiki on January 26, 2021. Dekwi is an activist with the Jericho Movement, which supports U.S.-held political prisoners and prisoners of war. She is also a teacher, an author, and a radio host on WBAI in New York. Dekwi is married to Sekou Odinga, who was imprisoned for over 33 years for fighting for the freedom of black people and the building of the Republic of New Africa. This recording begins with part of an informal conversation I was having with Dekwi. It then transitions into the full interview that was excerpted for the Caging and COVID episode. We pick up in the middle of our discussion on the importance of having a long-term perspective about the process of revolutionary change.
The system of capitalism has done us such a disservice that we think everything has to, you know, like you're going to see everything. And sometimes you're not.
Absolutely.
But you don't not do because it didn't work out the way that you was working towards, or, you know, you keep at it. So that's one of the important things to teach young people, right? And that comes with the political education that, you know, people have been struggling for hundreds of years. They didn't see some of the victories that we saw, but they still participated because they understood that it was looking ahead. So it's not just getting people out in the streets. It's getting them to understand that being out in the streets is one part of it, but that it's also protracted.
That's so important. I just kind of reflect back myself, you know, back in the 60s, I was convinced the revolution was 10 years away, and there was reason to think that, right? And then you kind of go through this time where, oh, it didn't happen, it's never going to happen, I'm so depressed. And then you just kind of realize history does not necessarily move on the timeline of your mortality, as much as we would like it to, you know.
Love that, right?
But we're making a contribution, and we're part of a bigger process, and we have to have that kind of perspective where it's very easy to get...
to feel defeated and, absolutely, you know, like it's not making a difference, but it does all. But I love what you said, because, yeah, people did really believe revolution was in their lifetime. Like, it was there, but you had the examples. Look at what was going on around the world. It was easy to see that and to have vision that this could happen here. So,
No question, which I think is what makes it much more difficult for younger people who never had that experience,
right,
you know, and never really had, never saw in front of their eyes imperialism getting its ass kicked, not just in one place, but, you know, all over Africa, Asia, and Latin America. So I think that vision, those experiences stick with us and the older generation in a way that it's much harder for the younger folks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I'm going to start here. Dekwi, welcome to COVID Race and Democracy. Thank you for being here. Can you please introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us what's most important for listeners to know about you?
Well, greetings and good evening. Thank you for inviting me and inviting us. And when I say us, I'm always talking about our captured, imprisoned freedom fighters, our political prisoners. So that's the us. I am an educator, an activist. I work with and on behalf of U.S.-held political prisoners and prisoners of war, folks who were part of the revolutionary radical struggles of the 1960s and 70s, who many are now in their, well, they're past their 60s mostly, and in their 70s and even 80s, and they've been in prison since the 70s and 80s.
You said you were a teacher and an activist. I also understand you have been a radio producer and a book editor as well.
So, yes, my co-host and I, Sally O'Brien, we co-host and co-produce a show called Where We Live on New York's WBAI. And it is a show that deals specifically with the U.S.-held political prisoners of war, survivors of and their family members of police terror, violence and murder, grassroots issues, and Puerto Rico. And yes, I've also had some articles published. I've contributed to a number of books. I co-edited with Matt Myers a reissue of the collective autobiography of the Panther 21, which, and then it was called Look for Me in the Whirlwind, the second one that we did, the reissue, which is two books in one. It's entitled Look for Me in the Whirlwind from the Panther 21 to 21st Century Revolutions. And what it is when I say two books in one, the original issue of Look for Me in the Whirlwind was so expensive. Like, people had gotten hold of it and it was like on eBay and Amazon for hundreds of dollars. So we had a discussion and Sekou and Matt started talking about doing the book over again. So it's the original manuscript for Look for Me in the Whirlwind with updated essays and contributions from some of the surviving members of that Panther 21 case. And I co-edited it as well as wrote an article. The book is dedicated to Sundiata Okoli, who was also one of the 21 and remains in prison today.
All right. We'll encourage listeners to check that out. Let's start by clarifying our language a little bit. What do you mean when you refer to somebody as a political prisoner? And how is that different from someone you'd call a prisoner of war?
Well, when we talk about political prisoners, one I'd like to say is that, you know, because people often lump all people in prison in the similar category as political prisoners. And I think that it doesn't mean to minimize or dismiss that people are in prison for the political economy and the political nature of this country. But when we talk about political prisoners, we're talking about people who were actively engaged in ways that challenged this capitalist system, that challenged the country. So they're in prison because of their beliefs, because of their writings, because of their actions, because of their associations and or membership in organizations. And they're in prison simply because of their political beliefs. And when we say prisoner of war, those are the individuals that were actively engaged in the military formation, defending and struggling against this system.
Now, obviously, the U.S. government's definition of who is a freedom fighter and who is a criminal is very different than both international law and certainly what social justice or liberation movements would say. When you're defending a prisoner of war, how do you make the case for the right of oppressed peoples to engage in more militant forms of struggle?
Well, one is that the oppressor doesn't have the right to tell people how they should defend themselves or fight for their freedom. And it's also written not only in the Declaration of Independence, but international law, people have a right to fight for their freedom. And as African people in particular, there was a war declared on people when we were kidnapped in 1619. There was a war declared on indigenous people when they came here in 1492. And people have been struggling for the right to their land, the right to their culture, the right to their language, the right to their self-determination, the right to their liberation, their right to live. And so that is the war that has been waged against African indigenous people from 1492 until now. And so people have been engaged in that war in different manifestations across the centuries.
There are a lot of people in this country who aren't aware that the U.S. has political prisoners and prisoners of war. Can you give us a brief overview? How many political prisoners and POWs are incarcerated? What kinds of organizations and movements do they represent?
Well, part of the reason why there are political prisoners and prisoners of war is because resistance is criminalized. And so there goes the differences in how oppressed people define people who fight for their freedom and the state power structure, the capitalist power structure defines people who fight. Resistance has been criminalized. And so in order to counter that, there have been organizations like the Jericho Movement for Amnesty and Recognition of U.S. held political prisoners and prisoners of war. There have been people who have had individual defense committees and organizations that advocate for recognition and advocacy for the freedom, and then also the awareness and the support. When Sekou came home from prison, he co-founded an organization called the Northeast Political Prisoner Coalition that's made up of different organizations and individuals that work on behalf of political prisoners. And that's the biggest challenge that we have is that the state, the corporate media, the history books have so demonized and criminalized resistance, not just here, but anywhere people resist, that people often ask, well, what did they do? When the essence is that they were fighting for freedom, and that has been criminalized. Harriet Tubman was criminalized in her lifetime. Had she been caught and captured, she would have been a political prisoner until they hung her. And so anyone who has fought Nat Turner, he was a political prisoner of war until when he was captured and when they assassinated him because of his actions in the war for liberation. So long as a war against Black liberation continues, there will always be political prisoners, because we know that where there is oppression, there is resistance. And where there is resistance, there is repression. And that repression comes in the form of the criminalization, the imprisonment, and the assassination. So that's why right now we have about 10 members of the Black Panther Party who remain in prison. But there are white anti-imperialist political prisoners. There are political prisoners from the American Indian Indigenous Movement. There are Puerto Rican political prisoners, because oppressed people fight. Oppressed people resist. And of course, their resistance is then also criminalized. There are many political prisoners. Today, those who protect the earth, those who fight against animals being tested, those who fight against this technology oppression that is happening, they have become political prisoners. Muslims have become political prisoners just because they are Muslim, and the demonization of Islam and Arab folks. So there are so many more political prisoners that came in after the war on the revolutionary struggles of the 1960s, particularly the war on Black liberation. But in those 40 years, there have been so many more political prisoners added to that list.
You mentioned Sekou, but I don't think you've said who Sekou is.
Sekou Odinga was a member of the Black Panther Party and a soldier in the Black Liberation Army. He was also one of the defendants in the Panther 21 who escaped capture in 1969 and ended up over in Algiers to help establish the international section of the Black Panther Party. He stayed there for a number of years, came back here to the States and worked underground. He was captured in 1981, October 23rd, 1981, and charged and convicted with the liberation of Assata Shakur, who is now living in exile in Cuba, and the attempted murder of six police officers for defending himself. And he was convicted and sentenced to federal time as well as state time. Well, they took him to the federal system first, where he did 28 years, and then he maxed out of that 40-year sentence, because he was sentenced to 40 years on the federal charge and then 25 to life on the New York State charge that they put against him for defending himself against the police. So he did the 28 years in the federal system, came to New York State in 2009 to begin the New York State sentence of 25 to life. And once he got back here to New York, he and his jailhouse lawyer started working for his freedom, that New York State had lost their jurisdiction of him because they turned him over to the federal system. And he won on that technicality. And so he was granted a parole hearing. And much to all of our surprise, he was granted parole. So we know that they gave him parole because that was a way to keep tabs on him. So in 2014, November 25th, I think it was. Yeah, November 25th, 2014, we went to go pick him up from Clinton facility in Dannemora, New York, which is about an hour from the Canadian border here in New York State. And he's been home since 2014. He was on parole for a number of years. Then he was released off of federal, and then he was finally released off of state. So he is completely with limited freedom. Whatever limited freedoms those of us who have never been in prison consider we have, he has those limited freedoms because he no longer has to check in with the parole officer. He doesn't have to get permission to travel. He doesn't have to go for weekly or monthly visits to a parole office.
Well, we have to celebrate the victories when we get them, for sure.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, you actually are leading into my next question, which is, you painted the overview of the types of movements and organizations political prisoners and prisoners of war come from. What kind of institutions are they held in generally, and where are they? So are they more in, you know, maximum security? Are they in federal, state? Where are they generally housed?
They're all over this country. There are folks who were charged in federal RICO, because while RICO was created to go after the mafia, they used the RICO conspiracy laws to go after the Black Liberation Movement. And so when it's a RICO, that's a federal charge. So you get charged in federal court. So you do federal time. So there are people who are doing federal time. Veronica Bowers is doing federal time. Dr. Matulu Shakur is doing federal time. And then there are people who are doing state time, like Sundiata Okoli, who was on that turnpike with Asada Shakur that May 2nd day, as well as with Zaid Shakur, who ended up being murdered. Asada was captured that day. Sundiata escaped for a little while, but then he was captured. So he's doing state time because that was in New Jersey. However, he is held in the federal facility. The same thing with Imam Jamil Alameen, the former HRAP Brown. He was accused of and convicted of killing a sheriff in Atlanta. And when the case happened, they said that they had shot the person who shot that sheriff. Yet when Imam Jamil was captured, he had no bullet wounds. He had no wounds that showed that he had been shot. But they were so glad to get him that even the FBI said at the time, "We finally got him." So Imam Jamil, although he is convicted in the state, he is held in the federal facility. And so while this government refuses to acknowledge verbally the existence of political prisoners and the imprisonment as unjust for political reasons, the treatment, the acknowledgement that they get behind the wall by prison guards and prison administrators, that they're singled out. They're denied some of the most basic, if you want to call them privileges, some of the most basic access that social prisoners receive are denied people who are political. So whether it's visits, whether it's Albert Noah Washington, may he rest in power, was one of our political prisoners. He was here in New York State. They denied him the right to get married just because the warden said no, right? So they get particular kind of treatment singled out for them, like taking their mail, taking their merchandise, tossing their cells, all kinds of ways. And they're sent to the worst facilities. Part of why Sekou won his legal victory when he got here in the state, because they wanted to make sure to punish him, they sent him to the worst prison that existed at that time, which was Marion, a federal facility. They weren't supposed to, because the judge had said for him to go to one of those places here in New York. I don't remember if it was Greenhaven or whichever, but it was a state facility. But they wanted to get him out and they wanted to make an example. So they sent him to federal, and in solitary confinement, Sekou did 19 years in solitary confinement. Russell Maroon Schultz, who is in Pennsylvania, did like 20 years in solitary confinement. Matulu is in, well, he's no longer in Florence, but Florence is like underground. Right. So we're talking about people who are made to do not just inordinate sentences, but an inordinate amount of time in solitary confinement, because they do not want them to have any contact with the general population. And they want to particularly punish them for having the temerity and the nerve to dream of freedom and to actively fight for that freedom.
Wow. So on top of all of that, we had the pandemic. In the part one of this program, we heard a lot about the horrific and deadly conditions in jails, prisons, and detention centers during the pandemic. I'm wondering in what ways the conditions may be even worse for political prisoners and prisoners of war in terms of the pandemic.
It's definitely worse. First of all, we have lost so many political prisoners due to medical neglect. Before, during, and now. COVID. And so we have political prisoners who have contracted COVID. Russell Maroon Schultz has gotten COVID. Sundiata has gotten COVID. Matulu has gotten COVID. Kamal Siddiqui has so many health issues because he has an ulcer on his leg that they have refused to treat. And that is something that's been going on for years. And we've had to have different campaigns just to have him have a doctor look at it. So these brothers are elders now. Like I said, they're in their 70s and 80s. So in addition to the regular health issues that come with being 70 years old, then you have the prison medical neglect. And now you have COVID. So I spoke to one of the brothers and he said that he's in Butner, North Carolina. And he said it is raging. COVID is raging through that facility. Every couple of days, they get to come out for an hour to use the phone because they're in a state of lockdown. That's their way of treating it. Like here in New York State, prisoners are made to make the hand sanitizer, but they can't use it, right? The medical neglect. That's why people call them the death camps, because they do mean for people to die on the inside. I mentioned Kamal Siddiqui. He's another one. The only reason why Kamal Siddiqui is in prison, he is the father of Asada Shakur's daughter. In the early 2000s, when the bounty on her head was $1 million, the FBI came to him and said, "We want you to help us capture her, like lure her away, and we'll give you the $1 million. Well, of course, he refused and he let them know, "I'm not doing that. One, in principle, two, she's the mother of my child." They said, "Well, if you don't help us to capture her, we're going to make sure you spend the rest of your life in prison." He was like, "Okay, you cannot count on me to assist you in her capture." Well, they charged him with the death of a police officer that happened like 30 something years before in the 1970s, which they had to dismiss charges because they didn't have anything on him then. And then they recharged him, had the trial in Atlanta. The same judge that presided over the trial for Imam Jamil Al-Amin is the same judge that presided over the trial of Kamal Siddiqui. Both were convicted to inordinate sentences. And I think Kamal has something like 2 life sentences. And he has horrendous health conditions. Ed Poindexter just had heart bypass surgery about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. So all of these brothers, they have like severe health issues, not only because they're aging, but because of like 30, 40 years of prison medical neglect, the lack of quality food, vegetables, like because you can't send stuff in. I mean, it's murder by prison. And so they watch as people who, and this is not to say that prisons are the answer to anything, but when we look at how they're treated, they watch as people come in and out, go back and forth, convicted of similar charges, but they go home, whereas we have people that go before the parole board for dozens of times, 9 times, 11 times, 12 times. Sundiata has been eligible for parole since 1992. This is now 2021. In 2014, a judge ordered him released. The New Jersey Parole Board challenged it. They went to court. The appellate court sent it back, and the parole board won. He had to go back before the same parole board. They denied him parole and gave him like a 15-year hit. They want him to die in prison because that 15 years would mean that he'd be like 95 years old. Wow. So the treatment that they get is particularly pernicious and inhumane.
Clearly.
All while they say they don't exist.
Clearly. Let me ask you about the treatment of new political prisoners or POWs who've been incarcerated since the pandemic began. I'm thinking about all the people who've been arrested or incarcerated for the Black Lives Matter protests in the spring. You know, we've heard about hundreds, if not thousands, of arrests. We rarely hear what happens to them afterwards. There was the arrest of Grandmaster Jay of the Not Effing Around Coalition, which is a Black Liberation Militia in Louisville. Do you know anything about what's happening to those political prisoners and POWs in terms of both charges, conditions, or the pandemic?
I can't say that I do, but I do want to say one thing, right? Like the political prisoners that are going in there today, and I don't have to know the particulars, but I know that this is a state that loves to make examples of people. Like, this is what happens when you want to stand up against us, when you want to fight. So I would say, as my grandmother used to say, dollars to donuts, that there are some similar treatments, denial of basic access and solitary, because anyone that the prison feels can have a connection to educating folks or organizing them to stand up for their rights and to fight against the oppression that exists in the prisons, because we know that 40 years ago we had prisoner rights movements. I mean, not to say that those things don't exist now, but it was like inside out. People were leading. George Jackson was in prison when he was organizing people in the prison. So they want to keep people who do that kind of organizing and have those kinds of connections to people. They want to keep them separate. So I can only imagine that there's situations once behind the wall, particularly if people don't go to visit, if people don't support, if people don't write to the prison, call the prison when they haven't been able to get in touch with people, when they haven't gotten letters and they haven't gotten any phone calls. Like, it's so important for people to let the prison know that people that are in there have people outside, on the outside, who care about them and are concerned. So it's like, it's eyes on them without necessarily having your physical eyes on them. But it's like, we know that our people are there and we're going to be checking in to see how they're doing.
Thanks for that. Let me go a little deeper. You've made the case here very strongly that a lot of the state's motivation is to suppress dissent and resistance and liberation movements. And I'm wondering what you're thinking about the way the state has moved in the past year against political activists in order to justify increased state surveillance, brutality, and repression. So, for example, the attempt to divide the Black Lives Matter protesters as the good, peaceful protesters versus the bad, militant protesters. You know, the narrative of them as thugs and looters. What do you think about the way the state has been moving, particularly against political resistance in this last year or so?
I don't know that I see it any differently than what they've always done. It's just the media is so much more pronounced in the ways that they control the narrative, right? The difference between now and then, that even though the state was attempting to, with COINTELPRO, derail, demonize, and discredit the Black Panther Party with this demonization, the Black Panther Party had a newspaper that allowed them to tell the stories and show the work. The Black Panther Party was in communities so that when the state would be on television talking about how bad the Black Panther Party was or members were, that the people in the community say, no, they're feeding my children. And so there was a way for people to have maybe not balanced, but another perspective. And so now it's not just how they present the activists of Black Lives Matter, it's how they just present Black and Indigenous folks in every way, in every media conglomerate. There is a demonization that takes place around Black folk. And so whether it's a television show, whether it's a movie, whether it's their so-called news, whether it's their magazines, their newspaper stories, however, so that people don't really get the gist of what's happening. And so it makes it harder for us to be in control of the narrative to say, wait a minute, we have a right to struggle. And people don't even know that we have a right to struggle. And people believe that the state has the right to tell people how to struggle, right? How does any person in this United States and these politicians and historians and all of these people talk about it's so important to be peaceful protesters? Ain't nothing peaceful about poverty. Ain't nothing peaceful about police terror and murder. Ain't nothing peaceful about homelessness. Ain't nothing peaceful about people's children being miseducated. So by the time they graduate high school, they can't even fill out a job application or write a college essay. Black folks don't get peace from the cradle to the grave, but they want them to protest peacefully. People have to do however they feel that they need to express themselves. But I think it's a major contradiction to demonize people when they are outraged, because how long have people been saying, you got your foot on my neck and I want it off? So we whisper it, we write it, we write songs, we do all the ways. And then when you still don't get it, then I'm just fed up. I'm fed up and I can't take it no more. Right. And then you want me to be peaceful in the face of me never having any peace in my life.
That's very powerfully said. Thank you for that. And, you know, I think to make it even worse, now we have supposedly, in light of the Capitol riot that happened recently, now we have calls by liberals and so-called progressives for harsher laws, seditious conspiracy charges, more militarized responses, more surveillance that are ultimately going to be used to delegitimize and repress militancy by social justice and liberation movements.
That is for sure. You know, as I sat there watching that on television, I was traumatized, not so much because of any level of surprise that that was happening or that somehow I view that as my capital. I was traumatized because I thought about the thousands of Black folks who have been murdered at the hands of white mob violence like that. I thought about Tulsa, Oklahoma, Wilmington, North Carolina, Rosewood, Florida. I thought about the draft riots that existed here, right here in New York City. I thought about how so many Black folks ended up in Brooklyn across the river from Manhattan because they got chased out of Lower Manhattan, where there still exists an African burial ground. So I was traumatized looking at that just because it was a memory of white mob violence and what that has meant to Black people. And so just the fact that those people were able to go home. So here we are, what, 2.5 weeks later, and they're still making arrests, right? Whereas you had a Black Lives Matter protest that was, quote, peaceful, right? And all of those people were arrested, right? So these people went home and now they're being charged. But we know it's that saying, if they come for you in the morning, they're coming for me at night. Mass incarceration started with the war on Black liberation, right? When they were locking up and imprisoning the radicals and revolutionaries of the 1960s. Once they got that out the way, then they came after the Black men, right? With the so-called war on drugs. Then it was Black women. Then it was Black children. Then it was the so-called war on terror, and it was Muslims and Arabs. Then it's the war on immigration, and it's people who are coming to land that is really theirs already, right? They're always gonna start someplace. And it's always been said, when white folks have a cold, Black folks catch pneumonia. So they can start out using those laws against those people, that white mob. But we know, just like with COVID, we know that white folks will get it and they may be made some examples of, but we're going to bear the brunt of it. And when people don't really understand history, don't study history, don't recognize, like Dr. John Henry Clark used to say, history is a time clock. It tells us where we were, where we are, and where we're going. If people don't understand those elements of history, they'll just be repeating what the mass media feeds to us to say, yeah, we need to lock the mind. I'm not saying that there's no accountability. There's a problem that white folks can just do whatever they want to do and not have any consequences, right? But we got to know that just like RICO Act, with those RICO conspiracy laws were set up for who? Like I said earlier, the mafia. But who did more time for the RICO conspiracy laws? But freedom fighters, Black and New African freedom fighters. So we have to know that they can start someplace else, but we're always going to bear the brunt because we wear the brunt of every level of disparate treatment that exists in this capitalist system.
Absolutely. You mentioned a little bit earlier some of the activist organizing. Talk some more about the kinds of activism that's being done to support political prisoners and prisoners of war who are the organizations, and then what are some of the key demands of these organizations?
As I said, some people have individual defense committees, which is made up of, in some cases, family members like Imam Jamil Alameen, his son and his wife, because his son is a lawyer, is part of his defense committee. Mumia Abu-Jamal has a defense committee. Russell Maroon Schultz has his family and a committee. And also there are different elements in which people are fighting, like there's RAP. So there's release aging people from prison. So there are people that are doing various ways to support. Well, we can't really go visit, but there are people that make sure that political prisoners get letters so that they know people haven't forgotten them. And so I think I mentioned the Jericho Movement for Amnesty and Recognition of Political Prisoners, the Northeast Political Prisoner Coalition. The Movement for Black Lives has been picking up the mantle, learning about and supporting political prisoners. So there are a number of organizations, community grassroots organizations. And the problem is not everybody has a defense committee. So that's where the Jericho Movement and Northeast Political Prisoner Movement comes in, because they don't support any one particular political prisoner. They are, you know, in support of advocating for the release. So whether it's compassionate release, whether it's medical, whether it's elder clemency, there are different ways that people are advocating through the courts or through pressure on politicians to release people.
And is there a particular source or website you would suggest for people who want to get more involved in activism or stay informed around what's happening with political prisoners?
TheJerichoMovement.com.
Okay, thanks for that.
That's the organization that supports and advocates for political prisoners that have been in prison for the past 40 and 50 years, as well as those newer ones that I mentioned. People who have become politicized, because some people didn't go into prison political, but once they were in there, they became politicized. They get a particular treatment once they become politicized. Like George Jackson wasn't political when he went to prison, but he became politicized while he was inside, which made him a greater threat to the state of California.
Right. Is there anything that's important for listeners to know that I haven't asked you about yet?
I think that one of the things that you mentioned is important for people to remember. Any one of us at any given time can be a political prisoner. Because once you begin to say, I'm not going to take this oppression anymore, and I have a right to fight back however you choose, however you deem necessary for yourself to do it, then that means that you can become a target. You know, what COINTELPRO did, the counterintelligence program did 40, 50 years ago was illegal. But as you said, it's become legal now. So anyone can become a political prisoner. So it's so important that we know that with these individuals that we fight on behalf of and work with, right? Like they stood up for people. They stood up for people that they didn't know. They stood up for the future. And so they deserve for us to stand up for them. Everyone who has ever eaten breakfast in school or had their children eat breakfast in school, every person that has ever visited a free or sliding scale health clinic, gotten tested for sickle cell anemia, went to a food pantry, a clothing drive, like all of those things were the survival programs of the Black Panther Party that made them a target of J. Edgar Hoover's COINTELPRO program, in which they were imprisoned, they were criminalized, they were assassinated, they were driven into exile. But everybody has access. They now call them social programs. Well, that is owed to some of those people that are in prison today. That's owed to some of them who crossed over to the other side and died while behind the wall, as well as those who were released, like my husband, who came home in 2014. So we stand on the shoulders of those who are living, in addition to standing on the shoulders of those who have become ancestors. It's good to remember the ancestors and call their names, but we have living freedom fighters. And I think that it's important for people to remember the living freedom fighters and to remember if they come for them in the morning, which they did 40, 50 years ago, they're going to come for the rest of us. And they have been coming and they will continue to come. So it is important for all of us to know that we must participate in different ways in struggle. Everybody's not going to do the same thing, but everybody can do something. And none of us is free until all of us is free.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that. All right. Is there anything else you want to add?
Just that people can go to the Jericho Movement and they can find out about all these names. You know, they can see who they are, read about their cases, and see how they can help. You know, one thing that we learned from the 1960s and 70s, that there was solidarity across racial lines. I mean, we have white anti-imperialist political prisoners, African, New African. We have indigenous. We have Puerto Rican. Anything that helps us to get the word out and to have people saying their names and fighting for them in some way, advocating for them in some way.
Yeah. Well, you are a very powerful spokesperson. Your words were very moving and very insightful. So thank you really so much for taking the time and for just...
Thank you for the invitation. I'm humbled and honored by the invitation, so I appreciate it.
Well, the honor is all mine, and I'm taking the inspiration away with me. So thank you so much.
All right.
Okay. All right.
You have a good night,
okay.
Brother.
You as well.
All right.
Okay.
Peace.
Bye-bye.